Okay, Love folks, we're having a radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Brickell, where we answer your question, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archive of past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Brickell.
Okay, folks, hang on a second. I'm having horrible technical problems. Hang on a second. Okay, so having problems with the recording, which is giving me massive feedback. Hey, Greg. So I'm having technical problems. Okay, so, this sounds like actually this is all right. Hang on. Okay. For some reason, like Audio Hijack Pro, which I use to record the show, is requiring me to mute it, although it still seems like it's recording. Greg, do you have a way to locally record on your end?
I do.
Okay. If you could enable that, then we can definitely make sure to have a recording of the show.
One second here. I'm sure that I have it actually running.
I don't want to have the Blog Talk Radio version be the last.
Testing. Why is it stopped? Turn on this block. Here we go. Okay, we're recording.
Okay.
Theoretically.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Hang on, I just have one more thing. Sorry, I'm you know, like something happened and I didn't get my notes done get everything ready in the usual time here, my last show, and what do I do? But I'm like, sorry folks, I'm all screwed up. Okay. So here's what we're going to do is Greg and I are just going to pretend as if the music just played and now we are ready to go into Happy Sunday. So
everybody can hear us.
Yes. Yes. I think we're good on that. Okay. So 3, 2, 1, Greg, go ahead.
Oh, Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Welcome everybody. Welcome everybody, particularly to our last episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Even if I do Philosophy in Action Future, I probably will not do a radio show like this again, so I feel comfortable saying that. So, Greg, tell us what topics we have on tap for this week.
All right. As usual, we have a great set of questions on the future of the United States, the value of vulnerability, cheating to get a job back, and more.
Yeah, so I picked these questions knowing that this was going to be the last show, and I really like this as a last set of questions. It's one that's sort of a summing up of my views on a topic that I've had very strong views on. That's the first question on the future of the United States. The value of vulnerability, this is something I'm going to be talking about. This is kind of like where I'm going intellectually and psychologically, and so to give you guys a glimpse of where I'm headed. And the cheating to get the job back just seems like a good, hard-hitting kind of question, so I'm going to enjoy
it. Oh, yeah, that's a hot mess there.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So as I announced on Facebook and on the blog, Philosophy in Action is going on indefinite hiatus after this show. I will say more about that at the end of the show, but there is an announcement over on Noodle Food if you want to go and take a look at that.
Also,
folks, if you are listening live, you can post questions and comments that are in the questions and comments in the text chat at philosophyinaction.com/live. And basically what I really want to do for this show is just have a rockin' good time. So get in there in the chat, have a good time. There's tons of people in the chat right now. So let's go and have a great time with this last show.
Fantastic. If you had no other immediate news, we can just jump right in.
Yeah, sure.
The future of the United States. Is the United States finished as a free country? Lately, I've seen a lot of people in my circles claim that the United States as a free country is dead and done, that tyranny advances each day and it's not isolated, it's everywhere. These are mostly reactions to articles reporting seeming home invasions by police, the FBI's forensic hair match scandal, the other government abuses, The common claim is that the United States now has an inherently corrupt justice system where policemen can end the lives of citizens with impunity and get away with it. My ear okay. makes me feel that while this is evidence of a lot of bad things that shouldn't be tolerated, the reaction itself seems disproportionate. While there are systemic problems, I have the impression that it is not all pervasive and not hopeless. Then again, that could also be my inner optimist trying to tell myself that things are not as bad as they first appear. What is your take on the current climate of the United States? Do you think it is finished as others claim it is? Not enough coffee. What kind of tools could you recommend for somebody to use engaging the state of the country more accurately?
Well, my basic view here is that America is hopeless. It's corrupt to the core. We are all doomed. And, you know, all this stuff about me quitting Philosophy in Action for personal reasons, that's completely false. It's just like it's a false flag, right? I'm actually headed to my bunker with 20 years of food and, like, tons and tons of ammo. So, like, I'm on strike. That's it. Yeah. Like, no, folks.
Striking.
Nothing's happening.
Sure.
Yeah. So this is not a new topic for the show, particularly if you haven't heard it. I definitely recommend the long discussion that I had of the good in American culture from December of 2012. But I thought that this would be a good kind of final show discussion because it's my final take on this topic of secular apocalypticism and how to make your life good and not be getting down and doom and gloomy about all the crappy political news, of which there's plenty right now. I mean, all the like Trump Sanders, you know, like, oh God, no thanks, right?
Like, really? But not a good direction.
I know. But like just don't like it's not worth worrying about. And so that's what I wanna tell you about.
Okay, so go ahead and tell us, what's wrong with the doom and gloom views?
Yeah, so it's pretty much impossible to predict the future of politics and the future of the culture with any specificity as the doomsayers are trying to do all the freaking time. So they claim, you know, like here, this, you know, like environmentalism is going to like rapidly expand in this way, or religion is going to rapidly take over in this way. But what we have, in fact, is this super complex, ever-changing landscape of better and worse elements from a wide variety of sources. There's lots of back and forth. There's lots of, you know, like religion has an upswing and then it has a downswing again because people go, oh crap, like what that, like that's getting too crazy. Let's tamp that down a little bit. Or environmentalism, that's getting too nuts. Let's do something different about that. So there's this lots and lots of back and forth. And often what seems like a clear trend today is changed or reversed or softened in a few years. And there's also progress and regress in unexpected areas. And so it just makes things impossible to predict in advance. And then we also have new technology, which is developing at an unprecedented rate in human history. And then, of course, reality periodically asserts itself, and people actually learn things. Like, they do, in fact, learn that legalizing marijuana does not mean the end of civilization, and legalizing gay marriage does not mean the end of civilization, and people change their minds and develop better views. So, you know, like it's just not that simple that it can be predicted. You cannot just extrapolate from certain philosophical ideas that you see in the culture that like, oh, this is the clear direction in which we're going in. So consider some examples. First of all, the development of the internet has enabled the rise of the homeschooling movement in a really like surprising way, right? On the one hand, there is this massive dominance of the left over education, and people have lots and lots of egalitarian views about education. And yet despite that, the homeschooling movement has really taken root, and in part that's simply because the internet has made teaching resources available to parents in a way that they have never been before. It wasn't so much some kind of big ideological shift, although there's been some of that too, but just giving people the technology, giving people the resources made a big difference. Secondly, think about all of the cases of police misconduct that we're seeing. So do you think that the police were not doing this before? No, they were, and probably in lots and lots of worse ways too. What has happened is that now everybody has a smartphone and everybody is taking video and everybody is alert to this issue, and so it's come under public scrutiny. And the fact that so many people are irate about it, that actually indicates this is a good thing about our culture, right? Even though bad things are happening, this is a good thing about our culture that people are irate about it and that things are changing. Police are getting body cams as default. There's debates about how people do have a right to film the police in the course of doing their job. These are important things. Also, just another example, Uber and Lyft have challenged the entrenched taxi monopoly, and they've also opened up new and interesting ways for people who want to work or want to work part-time to do so. Like, that's just super awesome, right? And who could have predicted that 25 years ago? Nobody. I don't care how good your philosophy was. I don't care how good your knowledge of the culture was. You could not have predicted those kind of changes. And then we also have, and Paul actually mentioned this when I was talking to him about these questions, there's black swans that come up, like 9/11 or Edward Snowden, that have, these things have profoundly influenced the course of world events. And, you know, really, like, good luck predicting future black swans. Like, folks, that's not going to happen.
Kind of the definition of a black swan.
I know,
yeah.
Really. Really. So, like, yes, fundamental ideas matter, and there's lots and lots of fundamental ideas, more than just philosophy, that shape the culture. And those ideas influence how people understand and evaluate and respond to the events around them. But it's still impossible to predict with any kind of specificity over a lengthy time span, particularly at the abstract level of a whole culture. There's too many variables, there's too much luck, there is too much human choice involved. You just can't do it. So, like, please, folks, do not tell me that you or your philosophical maestro has some special power to predict the trajectory of American culture because you can identify the underlying philosophical principles. It is a pipe dream. But, like, there's no need to take my word for it. Don't accept my abstract argument here. Just compare the actual predictions of these people that they have made, let's say, over the last 10 years to the reality, and then go have a good laugh. That is the only thing that you need to do to realize that these doom and gloom sayers, these apocalypticists, are completely wrong. And one would simply hope that they would learn their lesson. I certainly had more of this kind of apocalyptic view at one point. And you know what? I put myself out there and was really, really wrong. And I learned my lesson. And I just wish that other people would do that too.
Okay.
And just one other thing. And Greg, you might be able to say some more about this as well. Oftentimes these predictions are a big problem because of just basic failures in objectivity. So they're often based on cherry picking. So they focus on negative news that's going on right now, and they compare it with a kind of rosy and false view of the past. Or when somebody says that, like, rule of law, particularly say in the criminal justice system, was overall better in the past, and that, or that they think that's getting worse now, that we're doomed, like, I just can't help but laugh, right? I mean, think about what it would have been like to be a black man living in the Jim Crow South. Like, better to be a black man in St. Louis right now, really, really, in a huge, huge way. So don't cherry pick the past. Beware of these basic failures of objectivity when comparing. And it is true, every generation complains that the younger generation than them. Yeah, they're all so much worse than we were. Every generation does this. And yet, in fact, human life has gotten demonstrably, provably better in that time period. So I think there's just something wrong about those judgments.
Yeah, it is actually humorous. I remember seeing a quote from somebody back in Greek times talking about how things are really going to hell with the youth today and the direction of the culture. And he's like, we're just doomed. And it's
right.
Like, oh, wow.
Right.
Not, yeah. Right. Same, same. Okay. So what should a person do if he feels bombarded by these negative views?
I recommend unfriend, unfriend, unfriend. on Facebook, basically, like, if there are people on your feed who are really negative all the time and who are pushing this kind of view, and if they're not personal friends of yours, unfriend them. There's no reason to expose yourself to that kind of negativity. It's not good for you, not doing them any favors either. Or at least, if they are personal friends, hide them from your newsfeed or something like that. Basically, you should be surrounding yourself, both in person and online, with people who are seeking out the best that life has to offer, people who are positive and happy and providing you with positive value in your interactions, and people who are just posting yet another story that shows that proves that, like, America is in the decline. These are people who are not offering you value.
Yeah, and I throw in that this isn't really turning yourself into some kind of Pollyanna where you're denying the real truth about this and that. It's that there's a natural bias in reporting and media, and now with ever better connectivity, better social media, and Tammy pointed this out too, that the rise of social media has made it so that the things you have chosen to subscribe to, or it's getting to be much easier to bring to you, and news reporting in general, hey, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yep.
Unhappy news is what gets spread. So that's one of my strategies is I unplugged from the daily news.
Yeah, yeah, and actually I'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, but yeah, just the connectivity that we have makes it easy for even innocent biases to really distort the way we see things.
Right, right. Now, in the past, I used to get really worked up about these stories of injustice, and I just don't anymore. There's just no point, right? I saw that I was making myself unhappy, and I wasn't actually doing any good in the world by being part of the rage mob, right? That wasn't helpful. And it was much better to actually spend that, like, emotional energy, that worked-upness, actually caring for myself or making the people in my life better off in some way, being more available to them, helping them through their particular problems. Right, as opposed to getting all worked up and getting in an argument with people on Facebook. And obviously, I'm continuing to fund the good work of the people who are effectively fighting these injustices, like the Institute for Justice. It's not that I don't care. It's that if I'm going to do something, if I'm going to spend my time or money or energy on ills of the world, I want that to be spent actually correcting them, not just being angry at them. Being angry at them does not actually help.
So better bang for the buck.
Yeah. Yeah. So second point is stop consuming the news, right? Doom and gloom, anger and anxiety. This is what the media sells. Don't buy it. So maybe instead of hiding friends from or unfriending or hiding people from Facebook, from your Facebook feed, you can actually hide major news sites or news sites that are like particularly the worst ones, the like real lefty rags or real conservative ones that are, you know, going on and on about Obama being the devil and so on. And Greg, go ahead and say something about your own approach here.
Yeah, like I mentioned before, it my world became a much better world when I stopped consuming. I didn't take the paper anymore because all that antiquated media, I didn't need that. And pretty soon I didn't have TV anymore because I was streaming everything. It's not that I was unplugging my TV. I just didn't get broadcast news. And I was reduced to my daily news just being the top of the hour news while I was commuting, but I even stopped commuting. So I didn't have any of the normal big media hitting me with the news. And gosh, that was a lot better because indeed it is the case that what they're selling is the unhappy news. The good news is so rarely reported by them. It's just not sensational enough. There's a really natural bias there. And my correction is, okay, I'm going to tamp that down. And I subscribe to things in my curated feeds include lots of positive stuff. Like I bleeping love science. That's great stuff. I love seeing
right.
Progress on various tech fronts and things like that.
Right.
So,
right.
There's a way you can adjust the news through your curation to not be hit with so much negativity all the time. And it was amazing how my outlook got better.
Right. I mean, I'm a firm believer, like it's way better for you psychologically. It's way better for everybody around you to share a really cute video of a cat petting a pig to sleep, which is what I did yesterday. Then it was super cute. Then to share, you know, like the latest outrage. It's better for you psychologically. It's better for everybody else around you. So more cats petting pigs to sleep kinds of videos, and less like angry fist about Obama, or angry fist about Bernie Sanders. It doesn't matter which way you go. Another thing to do is read more history. Learn just how shitty the past was. I'm serious about that.
Like, objectivity for the win.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we have, like, for example, when we do Moody adaptations of Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen and stuff, like, notice that the cobblestones are completely clean and swept bare. Like, do you think that a world run on horsepower would have been like that? No. Horse manure is voluminous, right? Just imagine the amount of shit, the amount of filth that people lived in the past. Just think about that when you think about how rosy the past was and how much better they were. And then don't just, like, we have this filtered view. We have the good ideas that have come down from the past for the most part. But there was a lot of really, really bad stuff. A lot of the ideas that we regard as, like, let's say critical enlightenment ideas was the minority, but it was a minority that won. So imagine being, you know, being that super beleaguered minority in the in the Enlightenment. It wasn't all roses. It wasn't all great. So I think that's really important. Basically, learn how cruddy history has been. Paul also suggested, just don't confuse the weather with the climate. Meaning, don't think that negative blips here or there, like Trump, Bernie Sanders, you know, all that kind of stuff. Don't think that means that we're going to hell in a handbasket. It's wait for things to settle out. One of the things that I have, because I don't consume the news regularly, is a much more long-term perspective on things. You know, like, I'm just not so worried about what's happened in the last 5 minutes politically. So I think that's important. If you do feel like you want to do something, by all means, go do something. Go fight some particular local or state issue that matters to you where you can actually be effective. That's really critical. Go do something where you can actually be effective. Or lend your financial support to people who are actually being effective. And I think particularly this means, at least, that the easy place to send your donor dollars that are super effective, that are they've got their philosophical panties on in the right way, is the Institute for Justice. So that's always what I recommend in this case.
Go-to recommendation, definitely. I have to say in the chat, immediately they started talking about cultural climate change being real, which is great.
Yeah.
All right. So a lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
America is not going to hell in a handbasket, and people who predict that based on philosophy are blowing smoke. To combat this view in yourself, stop consuming negative news and seek out the positive.
Indeed. Okay, some follow-up action here. Catrianal? I don't know. Mr. C asks, do you have any preferences at all for president in 2016?
No, and here's the thing. So one of the things I was really hoping to do was to get through this whole election season with pretty much not commenting either on Facebook or on the show pretty much about the presidential election, other than to say, like, somebody submitted a rapid fire question that was like, I'm thinking it's inevitable that I'm going to vote for Hillary. What should I do? And I was like, dude, like, wait, like, you are not faced with this choice yet. So.
And it's not inevitable that you'd be voting for her anyway. It's not infrequent that they throw up candidates and I just say, whatever, have a nice vote on that, guys. And I move on with my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, like, anyway, so my whole idea was I just wanted to get through this whole election season without saying anything about the election, because it just does not matter. Like, I'm even in a swing state, and my vote does not matter. Go listen to Eric Daniels' interview that I did with him on why voting doesn't matter. And for these big elections, the likelihood that I am going to swing an election is pretty much, it's zero. It is zero. So, yeah. I have no opinions on these things. I just don't give a damn. It doesn't actually matter to me. I'm like, the one thing I'm interested in is, because of the work that Ari Armstrong and I have done on the personhood movement, to see whether the Republicans back off from that this year. Last election, every Republican candidate except for one, namely Mitt Romney, that is. Every single one of them endorsed personhood. So I'm just curious to see, has that changed? Have they backed off or not? But that's just like, that's me looking at the cultural barometer. But again, not going to get even super fun about that.
It's one little piece, and I haven't noticed a real big backing off on that front, but, you know, happy to be surprised. Someone did comment here that we should vote for a fellow named These Nuts. It's a real person, and he's really on the ballot. These Nuts.
Yes.
Okay.
And Earl says, once you manage to unplug from caring about politics, it becomes a lot easier to laugh about the circus it all is, which is so true. Yeah. And you tell me, like, you watch the debates mostly as watching them for spectacle, right?
I have. Yeah. And I see the people at work, when I'm working with different groups, and I see them ramping up on debating this or that aspect. And I really do just laugh. It all just looks like such a comedy now. And I consume both debates. I sat back with my popcorn and my adult beverage and laughed my ass off at several points.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Yeah. Oh, and I heartily recommend Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy. He's been doing this running commentary on Trump's persuasion skills that he seems to be using to affect the things that he's affecting. And I got to say, it's highly entertaining.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
Yes. So as I mentioned, Philosophy in Action Radio is on indefinite hiatus after the show, so I'm definitely not asking for recurring tips. But the tip jar is going to remain open. And that's in part because I've loved doing the show, but I've never earned enough to properly compensate me, honestly, for all of the countless hours of work that I put into creating these 362 episodes. Not to mention the other projects I've done for Philosophy in Action. So I will be absolutely super grateful to any current and future listeners who do want to thank me, not just with kind words, which are always awesome, but also with a contribution too. So basically, feel free to throw money in the tip jar whenever you see fit, and I will be very happy to buy myself lunch with that. So again, you can always do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Wonderful. The value of vulnerability. Is vulnerability of value? In a recent blog post, you stated, "I'm opting for a vulnerability through strength and strength through vulnerability route." Could you please explain this idea? Why is vulnerability something that should be cultivated in the first place? It doesn't seem compatible with rational egoism, given that vulnerability and weakness are often used interchangeably.
Yeah, so the context of this blog post, well, it was actually a Facebook thread that I turned into a blog post on our cultural norms of masculinity and femininity. And in particular, I was commenting on the view that a woman with well-defined muscles, like Serena Williams or Venus Williams, cannot be feminine. And I don't just reject that view. I loathe that view with the passion of 1,000 fiery suns. I really, really do. It's based on the view that women have to be weak and helpless. They have to be at the mercy of the greater physical strength of men in order to be proper women, in order to differentiate themselves from men. And that is complete bullshit. And
wow.
So, yeah.
Sorry. That's a cool way of putting it, because that makes me stop and say, wait a minute. I know many females with well-defined muscles, and I find them to be very hot, but I've never noticed myself being homosexual. So, yeah.
Right. And I think that for people who have this view, and I think a lot of people have it implicitly, some people have it explicitly, and lots of people have it implicitly, time to go in and check your premises, folks. And check how secure you are in your physical strength. And this is for both men and women. So I don't want to rehash that particular issue today. I want to speak more broadly about vulnerability, the difference between vulnerability and weakness, and why being vulnerable, which includes acknowledging one's own weaknesses, is really essential to healthy psychology and good relationships.
All right. So let's get some clarity. What is vulnerability?
So the dictionary says that vulnerability is, quote, susceptible to being – let's try this again. Quote, susceptible to physical or emotional attack or harm, close quote. And I think that's reasonably accurate. Being vulnerable means that you open yourself up. And by doing that – I'm talking particularly about psychological vulnerability here. Obviously, physical vulnerability is a similar concept. But by being psychologically vulnerable, you enable people to know you better. You enable them to relate to you more deeply, to trust you. And in their response to you, if they respond well to you, you learn that you can trust them more. And so vulnerability is essential to intimacy. It's essential to psychological, physical, and sexual intimacy. But in the process, yes, you are also giving people the access that they need to do you harm. And that can be scary, and it can be dangerous, particularly if you're doing it in the wrong context or with the wrong kinds of people.
All right. So the way I was thinking about it is that We usually choose this. Well, in good cases, we choose it. And we're choosing it for the good effects that it could bring, like you just listed. And, of course, that brings the risks, too. It's kind of it's like a double-edged sword. It's a tool. And so the analogy that I used in the earlier meeting was that it's like when I allowed a surgeon to operate on my eyes, LASIK. Hey, these are pretty valuable to me, but I really want the better vision. So after a lot of careful consideration. I said, okay, go for it. You can touch my eyes.
Right. Yeah. go ahead. Cut up my eyes. Right.
Cut up my eyes.
Yeah. And then,
so
vulnerability, it means exposing the soft parts of yourself. You had said that in the production meeting, which I really liked. And that can be psychological soft spots, or it can be physical soft spots.
Yeah. But it's for a good purpose, though. You don't want to just be vulnerable to be vulnerable. That's just,
right. That is just weakness.
Instead, it's, It's choosing to, I'm going to show this soft spot, but I'm trying to get that over there. It's going to actually build resilience if I do this right.
Yeah, and so what I think is that vulnerability, it's not a virtue, but it's actually a moral amplifier. And so let's see if it sort of fits the two criteria of being a moral amplifier. So I think we can say, look, a person ought to cultivate a capacity and willingness for vulnerability, but then they have to exercise that selectively at the right times with the right people about the right issues, right? You're not going to do this all the time. And again, the point is not that you're opening yourself up to hurt, but that you're opening yourself up to benefits in intimate relationships with people. And then we can also see, I think this is the more interesting point. Vulnerability can make a good person better. It can make them stronger, healthier, more capable of deep and meaningful and trusting relationships with others. And it can also make a bad person worse. Not in the usual way. Don't think of like an evildoer here. Think more of somebody who is insecure, who is dependent, who is second-handed, who is manipulative. If they're being vulnerable, they can become more that way. They can be vulnerable as instead of saying, like, here, I'm an independent person, here's me, and are you willing to sort of encounter this? It can be, I need you, you'd better provide for me. That's the way in which they're being vulnerable, and that's obviously bad.
So can you say more about what you were talking about in the posting of vulnerability through strength and strength through vulnerability?
Yeah, so I'm gonna stretch myself here. I'm going to reveal a little bit more about where I've been psychologically over the last few months than feels really comfortable for me. But I thought about this a good bit, and I think it's actually important for me to do this in this last show. I chose this question because I wanted to say a bit about the directions in which I'm headed, both sort of personally, psychologically, and also intellectually. And that seemed important to offer the people who valued and supported my work over the years to say, like, hey, look, here's where I'm going. Like, here's the new frontiers for me. And, you know, I can't talk about this right now, but maybe we can talk about this. Maybe we can talk about this later. Maybe in a couple years I'll be ready to be writing or speaking about this. And then on reflection, it seemed really important for me to be willing to reveal a bit more, to end this show in an authentic kind of way, because one of the things that has been a problem for me with the show is feeling like I'm having to channel old Diana. And I've changed a lot, and it feels like I can't make the show compatible with who I am, both in values and psychology now. Not that I disagree with any of the philosophical principles, but just what I'm doing, how my approach is, what I'm thinking about is very different. And so I'm gonna end this with a bit of painful honesty about how I'm moving on from my focus on philosophy and its applications. And so basically what I'm gonna do here, this is kind of meta, so very good for a philosopher to be meta. I'm going to be vulnerable here, and I'm going to trust you guys, my audience, to treat that with kindness and respect. So here goes. So over the last few months, I've realized that I had walled off the most sensitive and vulnerable parts of myself for many, many years. Nobody forced me to do this. There was no pressure. It was something that I did to fit into the life that I had. And I did this. I walled off these parts of myself, not just from the people around me, but also from myself too. And so for me over the past 6 months, taking down that wall has been an ongoing enterprise. And it's been incredibly, incredibly difficult. It's been the most difficult period of my life. And again, I've struggled to be vulnerable. I've struggled to say when I feel hurt or sadness or fear, even with people who I know I can trust and people who I love deeply and who I know love me. And I've even struggled to identify those painful feelings in myself, because for so long I've wanted to be like tough and realistic and, you know, have all my ducks in a row. And so I've pushed away those feelings. And so I've really struggled with even identifying them. And I've also struggled to ask those people who I love and value for what I need from them. And I do have these overwhelming impulses sometimes to withdraw, to protect myself from that disappointment that they might not be willing to meet what I need. And I think this is likely surprising to many of you, because, you know, I seem assertive, I seem tough, I seem self-sufficient from the outside. I seem like the kind of person who wouldn't hesitate to speak her mind or say what she wants. And I have been that person, but I haven't been that person about my soft spots, right? Not about where I feel vulnerable. And in fact, I developed that tough exterior for a reason, right? To protect those soft spots. And I'm only now just dismantling that. And so over the past couple months, I've pushed myself really, really, really freaking hard on these psychological issues. And it's been super scary for me. The feeling has been like jumping off a cliff again and again and again. And yet in the process here, I'm learning that I can trust people, that I can be vulnerable with them, that I can tell them my innermost pains and fears and struggles and doubts, and then I can ask them for what I need. I can't do this with all people, but with some people, and I can get what I want out of those relationships, and things are way, way better. So as you can imagine, just the amount of progress that I've made over the last few months has required an enormous amount of psychological strength and fortitude. And that's the vulnerability through strength part. So for me, what I see here, what I see now, is that being vulnerable isn't about succumbing to weakness. It's about being strong enough to be vulnerable with the right people, because being vulnerable, that's the scary, difficult, risky thing. And the result of that work is that I'm much, much stronger as a person. I'm more secure. I'm more robust. And that's the strength through vulnerability. So strength is also the result of vulnerability. So there's a virtuous cycle here. And what that means, that strength through vulnerability, is that it means that I can be hurt without being utterly devastated. I have the strength to endure that in a way that I didn't have before. I have a capacity to accept people for where they are and not feel like it's about me. And I have a capacity when people are acting in an uncalibrated way to go like, wow, that's about you. I'm sorry that's where you are. Now, for those of you who might be interested in this, in pursuing this kind of path in any way, shape, or form, one fruitful avenue for me here has been something called authentic relating. I was introduced to this through an old friend of mine, Joshua Zader. And basically, this is a set of games and practices that help create trusting connections with people, even with total strangers, in a very safe space and in a very safe way. And I did this actually just last weekend in a one-day workshop with Sarah Ness. And and I've also done this with Joshua on the phone a little bit. It's rather magical in the moment. So there's just this like amazing, like wow kind of feeling that this is happening. And then what you're getting is really great training in the skills and the mindset required for open, honest, first-handed, accepting, caring relationships and communication. And so if you're interested in that, if that's something, it's definitely a kind of like a hippie kind of thing. So expect that kind of crowd. If you're interested in that, you should see the work of Sarah Ness in she's out of Austin. And I have a link in the show notes that somebody can post to connectioncore.com. And basically, that's where I'm headed in a way. So I don't know. The chat just got super, super quiet. Thank you guys for listening to that. I do hope that's of interest, and I hope that's of help to anybody who's struggling with feeling alienated from other people, struggling with feeling vulnerable and not knowing what to do with that. And I guess the one thing that I would say, and one of the reasons why Philosophy in Action isn't working for me, why I can't do it right now, is that again and again, I've found that good philosophy and all the hard thinking that I've done about the applications of philosophy to real life, that just hasn't been enough. That hasn't been enough to get my life and my mind in order. And in fact, that overly intellectual approach has been harmful to me in some ways. I'm not saying it's harmful to everybody, but that's come with a cost for me. And so part of what I'm doing in putting philosophy in action on indefinite hiatus is exploring territory that's further away. And right now I need lots and lots of privacy to do that. And that's what's going to happen. But maybe later again, I'll be able to share things with you in an authentic, first-handed way. And that would be really super awesome.
Okay. Good stuff. What's the take-home point?
The capacity and willingness to be vulnerable is a moral amplifier, not a virtue. It's extremely important to deep and meaningful relationships, and it's not mere weakness.
Excellent. All right, a little bit of follow-up action here from Vicky. Do you have any specific suggestions for cultivating vulnerability in close friendships?
So definitely check out the Authentic Relating community if there's anybody doing that in your area, by all means, go take a look. The other thing, there's also Sarah has put out, I believe it's actually still available as a free PDF, a set of authentic relating games. Now, some of these are for groups, and they would require somebody who knows what they're doing. But a bunch of them are things that can give you ideas for just having, I don't know, playing a game with another person that can be really interesting and really revealing and really helpful for bringing people closer. So, Vicky, if I have a copy of that, or I can point you to the link, or anybody else who wants that, I can send you the link for that. It's really interesting, it's interesting how well these things work. They seem weird, they seem a bit hokey, and yet, like, all of a sudden you're in the moment with this other person, and you, like, wow, you have this connection with them, and you feel like I can trust them and I can tell things to them that I wouldn't normally tell somebody that I've known for 15 years.
All right. And Mr. C, I think KPOM, hey, new name for KPOM. How do you separate the good stuff from the typical hippie leftist nonsense?
Oh, with this, so I don't. There's no problem with that I've seen in Sarah Ness's approach in the authentic relating games or any of that kind of stuff. It's just that a lot of people are interested in this are people on the left. So just expect that out of that community. In the same way, it's weird. So I'm doing both of these things in a way, the strength through vulnerability and vulnerability through strength. I feel like both of those I'm exploring in a physical realm through Krav Maga and in a psychological realm through this authentic relating. And the authentic relating community is definitely like lefty, hippie, granola crunchy, and the Krav Maga community is definitely more conservative leaning. And so I feel like I'm in these two opposite worlds in that case. But I'm finding in both cases, I'm finding super awesome people, and I take what I want and I leave the rest.
Indeed. And Earl asks, do you plan on keeping the blogging up, even though
No.
you might be stepping away from these other things?
No. I mean, I might periodically blog stuff if I feel the urge, but right now I'm just very happy to be letting that all go completely for a while.
Okay, taking a break. Your books and lectures will still be available for sale, right?
Yes. So that includes my book, Responsibility and Luck. It includes the course in the book, Explore Atlas Shrugged. It includes the podcast on finding good prospects for romance and friendship. It includes my lecture, Should You Try to Be Morally Perfect? And if you're interested in all that, you want to find the links to that, go to philosophyinaction.com/premium. By the way, the lecture series or the podcast series on philosophy of religion is going to remain unfinished for now. You know, again, maybe in the future I'll finish those. If you bought that, I will be contacting you about a refund sometime in the upcoming week.
Okay. Moving on. Cheating to get a job back. Should I cheat the system to get my job back? For my main source of income, I work as a virtual call center agent through a freelance company that hires people as independent contractors rather than employees. I don't love the job, but the flexibility it provides is vital to my way of life and pursuit of my central purpose. The arrangement is totally impersonal. Nobody at the company that provides the work knows any of the workers. One pretty much just signs up, submits to a background check, and starts working. I recently got fired from the job for violating a company policy that I thought was unimportant. Once you get fired, you can't work through them again. However, there are several ways I could do the job again. One is to create an account using my dad's identity with his permission and have him pay me the wages. The other is to get a new social security number by faking the theft of my own identity, which I would do without stealing any money from anyone. Once I get a new social security number, I could create a new account and continue undetected. I don't want to be dishonest, but I don't want to change my way of life either. What are the moral and practical implications of what I'm considering?
So I realized, Greg, that I forgot to interject when you read the very first question. So maybe you should
yeah.
Read that one again.
First sentence of this entire thing was, should I cheat?
No.
The yeah. system. Yeah. No. 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 No.
No. No. No.
Holy cats! No.
Right. Yeah, this is a heck of a question. And I'm going to start by reporting on what my initial reaction was to this. I'm going to be very blunt here, and I'm not very sympathetic. And I'm reporting on this because I think it's informative. Because initially my thought was, wow, this is truly awful that a person would even consider doing this. Like, the questioner, you are not a person that I could ever trust. You're not a person that I'd wish to know. I would never, ever wish to work with you or for you in any way, shape, or form. And that's because these proposals here, they are so wrong. They are not small lies. They are not white lies. But they seem like cheating the company on a massive scale, trying to extract a paycheck from them by fraud after they fired you for willfully breaking their rules. And that's really, really, really bad. That's really bad. And so that's my initial reaction. I'm going to come back to that later because I do think that matters. So then during our production meeting, Arthur, who, as I've mentioned before, is far, far more benevolent in thinking about people's motives than I am, proposed the following. He stepped in with the following thought. Maybe the company was actually really happy with his work, but the company has this dumb and flexible rule that everybody involved in the firing knew it was dumb and inflexible, but the rule still required his firing. And now, basically, this person, this questioner, is trying to find a way to return to a win-win relationship with the company by circumventing that rule, by finding some other way to get rehired. And it's not an attempt at cheating or defrauding, but really an attempt to resume this genuine trade in a fairly anonymous relationship. And I think that would be something different. That's not quite so appalling. And yet it's still terribly, terribly wrong to attempt. It shouldn't even be seriously considered. And it wouldn't be, Mr. Questioner, if you really understood the moral wrongs and the practical dangers of dishonesty. But what I'm going to do here is I'm going to assume that's the situation. I'm going to assume that's your motive, because that seems more plausible given that you wrote me asking for advice. And I have done 361 shows before in which, not that I've discussed honesty in every single one, but it should be really pretty clear that I'm not just going to say, oh, yeah, this sounds like a fine idea, no problem.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about the moral wrongs and the practical dangers of dishonesty in this kind of case.
Yeah. So most obviously, you are considering basically forming a fraudulent contract with this company by faking your identity in some way to be hired. So, I mean, it's possible that the company could sue you for any, oh, pardon me. Hi. Hang on a second. Sorry. It's possible that the company could sue you for wages that they paid you. You might have big legal fees. You might owe damages. And then you have other problems because you've got government involved here. God, sorry, folks. I have got to pause and blow my nose. Hang on a second. This is horrible.
This is the part where I'm supposed to vamp, filling the air, talking about nothing in particular while she blows her nose. And she should be back any second. That's cue Diana, any second.
Okay, here I am back again. Sorry about that, folks. Tammy, if you could put a note in the show notes about what time it is so that I can delete that from the podcast, that would be great.
Awesome vamping there. There's no need to delete it, really.
I'm recovering from a cold, so, you know, this kind of thing happens. Okay. So let me start that segment over. So most obviously, you are considering forming a fraudulent contract with the company by faking your identity in order to be hired. So it's possible that the company could sue you. You'd have big legal fees. You might owe them damages. You might end up at a major financial loss. Moreover, if you use your father's identity, that's also IRS fraud. Not good, right? Really, the IRS does not look kindly upon that. If you pretend that your identity was stolen, that's Social Security fraud of some kind, and the government is not going to look kindly on that either. So basically, you are putting yourself in major, major legal danger by committing fraud here. Fraud both with respect to the company and fraud with respect to the government. These are not good ideas at all, at all. Now, so that's the most obvious point. Somewhat less obviously, most of the dangers, maybe not all of them, but most of the dangers of dishonesty apply here. You might be obliged to tell further lies in order to conceal your original lie, and each lie increases your risk of detection. And then if the lie is discovered, people will likely have the very same reaction that I reported at the outset: moral horror, major distrust, and you will not have the opportunity to explain yourself and say, no, really, I was trying to create a win-win relationship, and it was just such a stupid rule, and everybody knew it was a stupid rule. No, you will seem like a morally untouchable person, particularly as an least obviously, but I think most importantly, you are going to corrode your own character. This is a phrase that, Greg, you have introduced me to that you use a lot. You're playing in the gray. right? This moral gray zone. And it's not, you know, 10% gray. This is like 90% gray here.
Yeah, you went and created the gray and danced around in it. And yeah,
yes.
And it's not good.
Yes. And if you're willing to do this once because it's inconvenient for you to find a new job, then what else will you do? What will you do next time? You are setting a very, very dangerous precedent for yourself.
And this is exactly what happens with people who play in the gray. There's a whole profession dedicated to playing in the gray as lawyers. They practice creating gray so they can play in it. And whenever they're successful and efficacious, that just trains them to do it more until I think that's where the stereotype comes from. You can see them coming from a mile away. It's like, wow, here's someone who just loves throwing dust up so that they can get away with stuff. Yeesh.
Yeah.
So that's why, I agree. This is the most important level to consider it at. If you notice yourself dwelling on ways to cheat or manipulate people like this, you should stop and ask yourself, what are you up to? It really is messing with your character to seriously entertain things like this.
Yeah.
There's a reason lawyers have that kind of reputation, and you don't want it,
right?
Least of all with yourself.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So that's bad. What should someone do instead?
Accept that you screwed up here by violating this rule and move on. Go find yourself another job. You might be able to find a better job. There's lots and lots of jobs like this with flexible hours, working online, whatever it is. Go find another one. This is not the only one. And at that new job, you damn well better follow all the rules, even if they seem unimportant to you. Because if the job matters that much, if you dislike changing jobs that much, then you'd better do your utmost to keep it.
The price is way too high for doing it this way. So the other thought I had was that look, just like the cover-up is worse than the crime very often, so in this case, the recovery is worse than the offense. It might have been that benevolent reason where it's just like, yeah, everybody knows it's a stupid rule. But this recovery from that is it carries such a high price,
right,
in your character. Just it really is bizarre that you would want to go to these lengths to reacquire that kind of job when you could use a fraction of that kind of thinking and effort to go and get another one a lot like it.
Absolutely.
And not pay that price. Don't do it.
Right.
Back to Diana's very first answer. No, 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 no.
Right.
No.
Right. I would recommend no on this.
Yeah. Okay, so I love this as your final question, too. Just like, really, you've been here 6 years. Did you guys get this? No. Should I cheat? No.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what's your take-home point?
So it would be morally wrong and practically dangerous to attempt to regain your job by cheating the system. Instead, accept that you screwed up and find a new job.
Okay. KPOM asks, and I really like that I know this is KPOM now because I don't know how to pronounce that name. Can you buy a VW after it cheated on the diesel tests? One can argue that the diesel emission tests are dumb and counterproductive. Reducing those things decreases fuel economy and boosts the carbon output. Is that perhaps the same line of reasoning as the questioner?
I would not trust a company that cheated even on the emissions test in the way that I've only vaguely heard about the VW case. So I don't know a whole lot about it. I would not trust the company not to have cheated in other ways. I know that the emissions tests are dumb and they're counterproductive and blah, 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 blah. But nonetheless, unless VW had a very clear policy about being opposed to these kinds of idiotic government rules and gave a clear justification for that and said that they were doing it for the sake of doing right by their actual customers, blah, 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 I would not think that they hadn't cheated on other rules too, just because it was, you know, it worked out better for them.
All right. He also asks, isn't the cover-up always worse than the offense? Because I said, you know, is often. Well, I can imagine cases where it isn't, like murder. Murder is really bad, and the cover-up might just be a lie.
Right.
So in that case, I would say, yeah, the offense is worse.
Right.
You know, lives and all that.
Right.
Further thoughts, Diana?
No, I would agree with that. I was thinking murder too, and rape, and yeah, other things in which you could tell a white lie, or not a white lie, but you could tell a lie to be like, no, I was at my friend's house, and like, when actually you were raping.
Not
a
doing
and,
a
like,
gang rape or
yeah,
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul's saying he covered up his genocide, and it was definitely worse than the original offense.
Yeah. think not.
Yeah. All right. Moving on.
Yes. And I'm going to Skype in Arthur now because he is joining us for our rapid fire questions.
All right. It's time to put Diana on the hot seat with this with questions drawn from this long and growing list. And I guess this will be the final time. It'll be in any old order. And usually there's not a lot of prep, but maybe somebody did some homework beforehand on this one.
Maybe, Arthur.
I see a lot of bullet points here. That's, yeah. Okay, so let's do it. What key qualities should a job seeker search for in prospective employers?
All right, can I be heard all right?
Yeah.
Okay, so for starters, in my defense, I was just looking through the rapid fire queue here and I noticed this and I was like, I have lots of opinions on this. And before I knew it, I started writing out all of my thoughts because, you know, that's just how I roll. So it was kind of unavoidable. So sorry for violating the spirit of rapid fire. as far as my substantive thoughts on it, I think here are some of the questions that you want to begin to ask yourself and of others when you're looking for a new position somewhere, and especially when you're beginning to interview. So one of the first things that I think is really important is whether you think you'll be able to do the best work of your life at this new place. In my view, I think it's really important that every day you're doing the best work of your life. And sure, you're going to have off days, but the overall trend has to be an upward trajectory. You always have to be challenging yourself more. You always have to be looking for ways to improve yourself and to grow. And you really have to have a lot of job satisfaction in that respect. I think related to that is what the culture is like at the new company. So for example, is it a meritocracy? Is it something else? How does leadership and management philosophy encourage individual growth, both personally and professionally? A really big and key point of this culture is, what is the caliber of your prospective coworkers? Are they brilliant, motivated people? Are they passionate about their work? Do they take pride in it? Do they have a strong sense of responsibility and ownership? Or, on the contrary, is it just a job and drudgery, which I think it's a very common attitude that people have about their jobs, and I think it's really sad. I think, especially in Silicon Valley, you see a lot of people who are really passionate about what it is that they're doing, and I think that kind of cultural trend in this area, which is where I live, essentially, is very, very positive. One thing that I like to do is ask anybody who's supposedly interviewing me an interview question. In reverse, I ask them, where do you see yourself in 5 years? One of the best answers I've ever gotten to that is, essentially, I find so much joy and fulfillment that there's a sense in which I can't even imagine doing anything else right now. That I took as a very good answer to that. And I didn't really have any preconceived notions of what I wanted to hear before I had heard that. But I really liked that answer. It really resonated with me. And it's not that the person hasn't thought about the long term and hasn't really thought about their plans or what have you, but it's more that there's a sense in which doing anything else is inconceivable because it's so rewarding to be doing what they're doing. So I thought that was really positive. I think related to all of that, you have to consider, how will this job advance your long-term career interests? And I'm talking here also about the work itself. Not just the company on your resume and the compensation and so on, but what skills will you learn? What experience will you be able to point to in your next big thing? So it's an integration of all these different dimensions of the same advancement of long-term career interests. The work, the skills, the knowledge, the growth, and your ability to then build a resume that will be valuable in the future. I also don't want to understate the importance of compensation. So don't pretend that this doesn't matter. A lot of people are very reluctant to talk about that. They feel uncomfortable quibbling over money or negotiating and so on. That, I think, is a very, very big mistake. I think it's definitely right to know what your worth is and for a company to judge you fairly and pay you for the value that you will create for them. So I strongly recommend that you know that I think that you will be thought of with a lot, you will be regarded with a lot more respect when you know that compensation is important to you. You're less likely to be taken advantage of. I think it's a very important dimension to all this. Don't make it all about the money, obviously. Don't be singularly focused on that, but make sure that it is part of the big picture here. And I think a sub-aspect of the culture issue, to kind of return to that a little bit, but I regard this as pretty minor, which is why I'm kind of leaving it to the end, is how the culture, or how the company sets up things like various benefits and perks. There's definitely a huge potential problem with how some companies set those up. They try to trick you into more work or FaceTime at the office. For example, clever timing of provided dinner, or other kinds of, you know, benefits and perks. Right? They want you to be at the office more. They think they're going to get more out of you that way, and so on. That can be definitely problematic. But there are some companies that, and it's a difficult judgment to make, but they're genuinely geared toward removing friction from their employees' lives and improving happiness and job satisfaction. And so I think differentiating between those two kinds of things is really important. For example, some companies will give you a $1,000 stipend or something like that every year for any kind of self-betterment, whether it's gym or whether it's any kind of classes or conferences that you want to go to. And that, I think, is really great and speaks toward the company's orientation toward something I mentioned earlier, which was personal and professional improvement. On the other hand, you can imagine a company that touts, oh, we have snacks all the time, and we have food all the time, and we have a game room, and we have all this kind of other stuff, and it's not really that meaningful, even though, you know, they can boast lots and lots of these kinds of perks. So anyway, my point here is just be alert to this distinction between benefits and perks set up to trick you into more work, and benefits and perks that are really geared toward improving employees' lives and happiness and removing friction.
Cool.
So that's basically all I have to say about it. I know that sounded super duper prepared, but
it was super duper.
I've been doing a lot, but I really have been doing a lot of thinking about this. So I mean, what I prepared actually did end up being somewhat just stream of consciousness, anyway.
Okay.
I'm glad we were able to get that in the last show. I had promised Arthur that of course we would save this rapid fire, which we were supposed to do last time he co-hosted, until the next time he co-hosted, but then there was not going to be a next time when he co-hosted. So that's why I'm glad we were able to squeeze it in here at the very last show.
Okay. So
thanks, Arthur. I think your sound quality is such that we're going to say goodbye to you. We're going to say goodbye to you now, because it was good for the question, but I don't know, like when you're coming in and coming out, that's actually a problem, it seems.
Totally fine.
Okay. Thanks, Arthur. Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Later, Arthur. Okay. Going a little more light here. Number two, why are zombie apocalypse movies and television shows so popular? It used to be all the vampires, but now it's zombie apocalypse stuff.
So
is there any philosophical significance to this? I'll add the sheen of philosophy here.
Yeah. I have seen some attempts to argue that there was some deep philosophical trend here, which, like, yeah, no, it was not very successful. So Trey says it's because they're awesome, and I would agree.
Yeah.
I love this kind of like fantasy genre. It's this, but it's not like fantasy where it's a whole fantasy world, but it's like putting fantastic creatures into our ordinary settings and see basically how life changes. Right? What does this mean for us? How is it we're going to survive? And particularly one of the things that I love about The Walking Dead is that it has this, there's deep philosophical questions in it about what kind of people do we want to be? When is life worth living? And is this life that we're leading now? And what kind of people can we be that makes life still worth living? Like if we are the brutal people who are only helping each other survive, is that something we want to do? Is that a life that's worth preserving? And so I love the fact that it's so philosophical, and it is this way of like taking things to extremes and then seeing, okay, how does this change things? Let's run a thought experiment. And I think that's a very kind of philosophical approach, or at least it can be in a lot of ways. And I also think that look, people are also about the apocalyptic type stuff. People are scared about the future. There's lots of people who think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And having apocalyptic type movies and television is a way of getting out those fears. It's a kind of cathartic effect. And I feel that too, or it's a way of it's like your worst nightmare come true in a way, not in the horror genre sense, in which it's so unrealistic and it's, Freddy Krueger coming at you in your dreams or however that works. But it's something it's imaginable in a way. And you think what would I do? How would I survive? What kind of choices would I make? And so you're seeing sort of the edge of ethics in a way. And I think that people really like that.
And all that's definitely true. And also it's a nice, as a writing device, it seems like it's wonderfully open-ended for creating all sorts of tensions and possibilities to just have drama.
Right.
And that's why maybe also
there's
it's
lots
awesome.
Of conflict. Lots of conflict. Yeah.
So, well done. Okay. A little more serious this time. Is a person morally responsible for the actions that he performs under duress?
So this, I would recommend, if you're interested in this question, to take a look at my book, Responsibility and Luck. At philosophyinaction.com/moral luck. So I would actually, I tend to think, so my basic view is I would agree with Aristotle on this, which is that the person is responsible so long as they have a choice, so long as they face alternatives, they are responsible for which alternative they choose, but you have to judge them in context. So if somebody is, let's say there's a mugger and they have a gun to your kid's head, and they're threatening to kill your kid or a stranger, and those are essentially those are the two options, and you say, don't kill my kid, sorry, kill the stranger, you're not morally responsible for killing the stranger. For one, the criminal is responsible for that, but you have to look at what the other alternatives were, and there were just no good alternatives. You can't condemn somebody for an act out of context. You have to every action needs to be judged in context. It needs to be judged, were there better options? Were there worse options that you had available to you? And so that's how you do those kinds of moral judgments. And oftentimes, basically, people can do things that are really quite horrible out of context. But in context, you go, wow, that's understandable. You faced a horrible, horrible choice. And you feel pity and you feel sympathy and you do not condemn them.
Okay, and now the flip side on forgiveness. Down here at the bottom, if somebody who did something unforgivable, incurred brain damage that both made them forget what they did and changed their character, would they be liable for their past actions?
No, I don't think so. They're not the same person at that point. This is a personal identity
mm-hmm.
question. So I don't think that people who are I'm not even sure that people with massive amnesia who don't even remember their past selves, I don't think that they can be responsible for that. But particularly if there's personality shifts and so on, you really have to say, look, this is just a different person. And they're in the same body, but they're a different person. And so they're not responsible any more than you're responsible for what your mother did.
And that goes to the purpose of when you're assessing someone's character like that, you're trying to think about what value are they in my life? What danger might I face for being near them? And well, you're saying that the things that made them really dangerous and not valuable are gone now. So, well, that's a new equation.
Right.
And even when you're busy forgiving people for something, that's what you're trying to determine is, are they sorry they did that? And will they? Can I be confident that they won't do it again? Have they earned my confidence there?
Right.
And again, this has been kind of eliminated by the fun question.
All right. I love Chris Lance follow-up. What if they get a new Social Security number?
Well, then we're golden. Yeah. All right. We can wrap this up maybe with the sort of implicit question for you, Diana,
uh-huh.
of where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Oh, actually, I'm not answering that question, which is actually useful to tell people. So a lot of people are asking me what's next, and I have plans. I have a vision for what I want in 5 years, but I'm not ready to talk about that publicly.
Yeah.
It's private. And so like, I understand why people are asking. This is not a normal thing that people keep private, but it's something that for, you know, I'm talking about with friends, with close friends right now and so on. But I'm not in any rush. I'm just really working on getting my life in order, and so that's the primary focus right now.
Yeah, Trey hears the evil laugh and sees the tinted fingers.
Yeah, no, it's actually very prosaic. It's like delightfully prosaic what I plan to do. So I'm actually really excited about that.
Well, let's wrap up the segment then. And I'm not sure how you want to do this. It is time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, the final episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. And I, for one, am very happy everybody was listening, and I really hope that they had a great time.
Yeah, I did have a great time, and I do what I want to do here, just so that it's in the podcast. I'm pretty sure that everybody in the chat has seen this on Facebook or read it on Noodle Food, but I want it to be included in the podcast. This is basically my statement that I did post to Facebook and Noodle Food about my stopping work on Philosophy in Action. So I'm going to read this, and then we'll do our usual wrap up. So here goes. After much reflection and agonizing, I've decided that I need to stop work on Philosophy in Action, at least for the foreseeable future. My life has changed tremendously in the past year, and I've changed too. I want to pursue a new career path, and I can't do that effectively while working on Philosophy in Action. Moreover, I need a private life, and I cannot have that as a public intellectual talking about moral philosophy and its application to daily life. That's not the whole story, but it'll have to suffice for now. I've loved my work with Philosophy in Action. I'm proud of the ways in which I untangle complex ideas and help people live more conscious, principled, and happy lives. I'm proud of the ways in which I've grown as an intellectual and as a person through it. I'm sad to be leaving that work behind, as much as I know that it's the right decision. I'm so grateful to the people who supported my work financially over the years. Quite literally, I couldn't have done it without you. And also, many thanks to the people who contributed to Philosophy in Action in other ways, including appearing for interviews, submitting questions, sharing links, and offering feedback. Moreover, the show wouldn't have been possible without the week-in, week-out contributions of Greg and Tammy Perkins, who helped me craft and deliver almost every Sunday Q&A for nearly 5 years. Paul Shea deserves a special mention and huge thanks too, of course. He was my intellectual partner, enthusiastic supporter, and silent benefactor for every episode. And I would thank Arthur Zay for being my backup co-host as needed, but I know he enjoyed it too much to need that. The six-year archive of podcasts and radio shows, 362 episodes in total, will remain freely available, and the premium content like Explore Atlas Shrugged will remain available for sale. The tip jar will remain open, too, for anyone who finds that podcast archive of sufficient value. If you wish you had contributed or wish you had contributed more over the years, it's not too late. I'm still open to the possibility of a podcast series or writing projects under the auspices of Philosophy in Action at some point in the future. However, I don't have any definite plans for that. Right now, I need a complete break to move forward with my life. Well, some of my fans are likely to be surprised and dismayed by this announcement. That's understandable, even gratifying. In response, I'd love to hear what you most valued in the show, not just in general, but about particular questions that helped you navigate life better. That would mean so much to me, more than I can properly express here. Now, after this final show, so in other words, sometime next week, I plan to withdraw from the very public online life that I've led for so many years. Please be assured that I'm doing well, and I look forward to seeing many of you in person at AtlasCon and elsewhere. Let me just make a note about what I mean by withdrawing from the very public online life. In particular, that means I'm going to be unfriending a large number of people on Facebook, and I'm going to be disabling subscriptions, and I'm going to make Facebook private. And I know that lots of you have an interest, people that I don't know personally, that I haven't met, that we have this kind of one-way relationship, would like to keep following what I'm doing, but I'm just not going to be doing anything philosophical anymore, and I really want to make that very private. And so, folks, like, please know that's about me, that's not about you, and I would be happy to refriend you if we do ever meet at AtlasCon or meet elsewhere and strike up a friendship. That would be great. So that's that, and I guess you can go down to the I'm Greg Perkins, Greg.
Well, yeah. So one last time, I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. You can drop by to look at the archives and give feedback.
No submitting or voting on questions anymore.
And we will not be here at the same time next week. And the URL, though, is philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for a great run. Bye.